Welcome to the Eldritch Estate, an establishment dedicated to the bizarre, the dark, and all that is otherworldly. We invite our guests to come and stay a while, to enjoy the haunted hallways, the shrieks of terror and delight, to forget time in our enchantingly disturbing abode. Whether it's for an overnighter or a week-long stay, our hostesses will see to it that you are shocked, horrified, and left morbidly curious about the goings-on here at the estate. Will you take a trip with us? We can't wait for you to see what's in store.
Hello, and welcome back to the Eldritch Estate. I'm Dusty.
And I'm Katie.
And this is part one of our season finale.
Oh, no!
Which also, like, let's talk about that for a second. We're at the end of our second season. What?
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
So yeah, thank you for joining us on this wild ride, and we have got a good one for you. This is definitely going to be a two-parter. There may or may not be another episode in between this. We're kind of coming up on Thanksgiving and Christmas and all that stuff. So, you know, we'll get the content to you. It just, the schedule may look a little bit different.
She might be a little broken up, but she's still beautiful.
Exactly. But I have 27 pages of notes here for you today, so strap in, motherfuckers.
Dusty does not double space.
The best part is, on Monday, I had 3 pages of notes. Today is Friday, and I have 27 pages of notes. So not only have I researched this and made extensive notes, but I've done it all in the span of, like, 72 hours.
She understood the assignment.
So, I am pleased to present to you today the topic of our season 2 finale, H.H. Holmes.
I would do a drum roll, but I think it's gonna sound really obnoxious, but I'm doing it anyways. After you announce it. True crime news.
True crime news.
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of crimey. Britney's fucking free, y'all.
Free Britney. Britney free.
She freed. Freed Britney.
Freed to Britney.
Hell yeah. This has been the hill I will die on for the last, like, 2 years, and she a free bad bitch.
Congratulations to Britney.
And Britishney and all her other personalities.
Absolutely.
We love her.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Cool. So, about H.H. Holmes. First of all, that's not his real fucking name.
Did he name himself?
Yeah. And wait till you hear why.
He BTK'd himself?
Hang on. Wait. Just wait for it. It's coming. God. It's coming. Okay.
Okay.
Herman Webster Mudgett.
Well, I would rename myself too.
I'm gonna say that one more time. Herman Webster Mudgett.
It didn't get really bad until you said Mudgett.
Mudgett.
It's basically like mud flap.
And I wasn't sure if it was Mudgett or Mudgett. I'm pretty sure it's Mudgett.
Herman Webster Mudflap.
Mudflap. Okay, so he was born on May 16th, 1861. He was born in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, to Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodate Page Price. He had an
Theodate.
Older...
Theodate. I like that. Theodate.
It's kind of pretty, yeah. It also reminds me of Theodosia, which, if you've seen Hamilton, there's the whole song, Dear Theodosia, and I just really like that name now.
Tell me why, it's just giving me Doja Cat vibes.
Hell yeah, Theodosia Cat, I love it. He had an older sister Helen, an older brother Arthur, a younger brother Henry, and a younger sister Mary. At age 16, he graduated from Phillips Exeter Academy and almost immediately took a job as a teacher?
It was Question mark?
It was the 1800s, he had absolutely no business being a teacher, and he was 16, so...
Well.
As a teacher, I'm offended on principle, but whatever.
Betcha he didn't even have to get fingerprinted.
Seriously, on God. He worked first at a school in Gilmanton and then moved to Alton for a different teaching position. It was here that he met Clara A. Lovering.
Do you know what he was teaching?
I do not.
Okay.
But at the time, it was probably like one-room schoolhouse.
A general education.
Yeah, the teacher teaches arithmetic. Yeah. Which, by the way, it's great that teachers are specialized nowadays, because you know what I'm really good at? Music. And you know what I teach? Music. Like,
and also math and writing and reading and all of the other things when you're forced to.
Yeah, we're not getting into that right now.
Sorry, bruh.
So with Clara, they had this really quick and heavy courtship, and they were married on July 4th, 1878. About a year and a half later, they welcomed their first child, Robert Lovering Mudgett, born on February 3rd, 1880, in Loudon, New Hampshire. Mudgett had now enrolled in medical school and was very busy with work, nearly ignoring his family. Despite how hot their relationship had been at the start, it cooled rather quickly, and we will see a pattern of this.
Lust.
We're gonna find out really quickly that Mudgett has a type, he has a strategy, he is very, like, hot and heavy at the beginning, and then he will dip. Like, he's really good at it.
He loves the beginning of love. And not the work.
He's a manipulative son of a bitch.
Yeah. Take what you want and leave. Yeah. I don't like that.
Housemates described him as being abusive towards Clara, and she moved out of their house in 1884, just after Mudgett graduated from school. As part of his struggle to pay for medical school, Mudgett took odd jobs here and there. One such job was working as a traveler for a book publisher. So he was assigned to sell books door to door across northwestern Illinois and then deliver the proceeds to the publisher. Instead, he pocketed the cash and traveled on the company's dime. So he literally got all these books to sell, he sold them all, and just traveled around Illinois.
Rude.
Yeah. It was
con artist.
Oh, yeah. Con artist is, like, if you looked up con artist in the dictionary in the 1880s, you would just find a picture of him. Like,
and it would not say H.H. Holmes, it would say Mudgett.
Mudgett. H.W. Mudgett.
Mudgett, fuck the budget.
Ooh. So while he was on this, like, tour de Illinois, he, experienced Chicago, and he kind of, like, fell in love with it. He doesn't return there for a little while, but you can tell it left a mark on him. After this, he kind of bops around for a while, various different towns, various different jobs. He worked for a nursery company, and he was even hired as a school principal.
Wow.
Like, he was just one of those people that's, like, super charismatic, silver-tongued, can talk his way through anything, leaves a great first impression, and people just had a good feeling about him. So they were like, you know, I think we should hire this guy as the principal of our school.
And you have to jump from job to job to job, because eventually they're gonna look at you and be like, motherfucker, you're not qualified.
Mm-hmm. He opened his own medical practice for about a year, but found it to be thankless and the pay inadequate.
Because you're not qualified.
Same, bro.
Well, I mean, you're qualified. I'm but qualified, he clearly yeah. was not.
Well, and at this time, teachers were not paid well, which, like, fucking still.
I was gonna say, what's changed?
Doctors were also not paid well. So he'd tried both. He'd tried teaching. He didn't really suit him. He wasn't making money like he wanted to. He'd gone to medical school, which was very expensive, and now he tried to open a medical practice. He had it for about a year, and he stood still. It wasn't enough pay, and he didn't like that nobody was giving him a gold star and a pat on the head for it.
I wonder if that's why doctors were doing some sketchy shit back in the day, like selling babies out the back door.
We're gonna talk about that a little bit too.
Oh shit, okay.
Like, if you need any, like, juicy shit, it's in this. It's in this 27 pages of notes.
I'm here for it. It's like a novella.
While I'm here, I mentioned this a little bit later, but I used a book for almost all of my notes, and I'm going to talk about it later, and I'll put it in the show notes, but I highly recommend everybody check it out. When we get there, I'll mention the name and everything like that.
Work.
So by 1885, he's poverty-stricken, and he's running out of options. He literally said, like, starvation is catching up to me. Like,
damn.
He needed a way to get money, and fast. So Holmes and a couple of his friends decide to make some fast cash in a way that was surprisingly popular for the time. Insurance fraud!
Let's just burn the building down.
Or, hey, we're gonna get an insurance policy in my man, you know, David's name, and then we're gonna fake David's death, we're gonna present a corpse, say that it's David, collect the insurance money.
Whose body did you steal?
Mm-hmm.
Grave robbing was also a thing at this time.
We're gonna talk about that, too.
Oh my gosh. It has everything. It baby really selling. Does. Grave robbing.
Absolutely. Oh, I didn't even say the best part of the name of this episode. Like, yeah, of course the name of the episode is H.H. Holmes, but the real name of this episode is fucking Murder Castle, bro.
Murder Castle Mudgett.
Yep. And here at the Eldritch Estate, you know we love us a fucking murder castle.
We do.
So they, he and his friends, they'd agreed to take out an insurance policy on one person, and then list themselves as the benefactors should that person die, and then provide a dead body to the insurance company and collect on the policy. This was the plan. After some deliberation.
Like, they had to give the body to the insurance company?
They had to present a body. They couldn't just say, like, oh, yeah, he died. Because the insurance company would be like, prove it.
No, where, bitch?
Yeah, and so they'd be like, here's a body. And then they'd have to, like, identify the body. And so, depending on how, like, what state the body was in, they could say, like, oh, it's unidentifiable. But, like, we know it's him. Or, like, oh, no, I definitely know. He had a mole on his neck right there. That's definitely him, kind of thing.
That's so dirty.
Yeah.
Okay.
So after some deliberation, they decide to take out a policy on a family of three.
Fuck.
I know.
They're about to steal three dead people?
They're gonna try.
Oh, fuck.
We're getting there. Stay with me.
Okay.
A husband, wife, and child, and then they would split the money between them. Mudgett was positive that he could use his connections in the medical field to acquire the bodies, because he's gone through medical school. Which he really had. Like, that's one of the only things that he says he did that he actually did.
Which, like, is a shocker, because usually people who are this charismatic and use their bullshit to sell their way through life, like, they don't actually do any of the things they've said they've done.
Right, exactly.
Oh, this has totally given me a... Fuck, I don't remember the... Was it the Pied Piper of Tucson?
Oh.
That guy that was, like, super, super hardcore con man.
Could be.
Fuck.
We're definitely going to do that case, by the way, because yeah. It's a local one and it's wild.
It's fucking crazy. Was that the guy that, like, elected himself mayor?
It might be.
And then gave himself this prestigious award. Fuck, I just listened to an episode about it.
Don't you hate that?
Yep.
I'll do that with cases all the time. I'll be like, was he the guy that... No, he did the... What? No, that was the other guy. And I'm like, fuck. And then I'm like, I have a true crime podcast and I can't keep these details straight. That's why the notes are 27 pages long, so that I don't tell you guys some inaccurate bullshit.
That's why there's like a megaplex of a spreadsheet.
Yes. All right, so he's pretty sure, like, with his connections in the medical field, he can get some bodies for this, right? Now, at this time, there was a shortage of bodies for medical practices and schools to study. Like, they just didn't have a whole lot of bodies. They weren't well preserved, or they weren't able to use them, or they just didn't have them. Like, they couldn't get them. So even doctors were grave robbing to get supplies for their work, because they needed them to study and do experiments, but they also needed them for their students to, like, learn anatomy and shit.
I've always really wondered why people are like, I donate my body to science. Like, I understand that they're researched and studied in, mm-hmm. like, body farms and all of the things, but, like, now I realize they do it so people weren't taking dead people out the ground.
Yes.
What the fuck?
You can volunteer to give your body so that we don't have to steal your body.
That's wild.
So the men decided that it would be too suspicious if they asked for three bodies from the medical school, and they probably couldn't get all three bodies from the same cemetery if they decided to grave rob them either. So they then decided that each man would provide his own portion of the family to be used for the fraud. So there's three men, you gotta get your own body, but then we'll split the payload.
I can get you some money, man.
Yeah.
And if he sells it to him at first, like, I got a guy that'll get us some body. Just kidding. Bring your own dead body.
Yeah, BYOB.
Bring your own body.
Bring your own body. Yeah, so that's what they decided.
You can't make it up,
bro. That's going on a shirt. I'm sorry.
It has to.
Oh.
It needs to be in the form of, like, a little barbecue invite.
Yeah, and, like, a zombie.
Insurance fraud. BYOB.
Little zombie dude. Okay, so, from here, according to Mudgett, take that with a grain of salt, he traveled to Chicago in November of 1885 and acquired his portion of the deal, but he needed money to get back to his, business partners?
Shall I say?
So prepare yourself for this. He placed the body in storage.
What the fuck?
And left for Minneapolis.
They did not have, like, temperature-controlled storage units at this point.
No. And you know what else? His partners are not in Minneapolis. So, like, the fuck are you doing, my guy?
It's like, this one didn't look like the picture enough, so I'm just gonna let it rot in a storage unit for a while?
Yeah, so then...
And storage at that time was probably, like, space you acquired from a person.
Or, like, a public space, like, when you would go to, like, a train station and, like, get a locker type thing.
Or, like...
Like, can you imagine having the locker next to fucking Mudgett and being like, what the fuck is in this locker?
Why does it smell so bad? Or, like, you know, this nice farmer you know, and you're like, can I, you know, purchase some storage space in your barn?
Yeah.
And then he's got, like, you know, a toolbox and some keys and maybe a couple clothing trunks and a body.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
And there's a bunch of flies accumulating in that area. Like, I don't know how he stored it. There was no information about that. Just that he, according to him, stored it.
According to him.
So he goes to Minneapolis. He's unable to find work there. And then in May of 1886, he leaves for New York. Just a friendly reminder, backtracking here just a little bit. He acquired the body, quote unquote, in November of 1885. It is now May of 1886. 6 months later.
In 6 months, is a person bones?
No.
I mean, it depends on the conditions. But you
would have some serious decomp. Yeah, it would depend on, like, the environment, the temperature, how it was stored, everything like that. But...
What the fuck?
It's not gonna be pretty. That's what I'm getting at here. So then, again, this is according to him. He wrote a memoir. We'll get into that.
Wow.
He then packed part of the corpse back to Chicago and packed the remaining parts of it with him on his trip to New York.
Right.
He then claims that while he was on his trip to New York, he was reading an article about how prevalent insurance fraud like this had become. And he began to realize that the insurance companies would notice it and likely have ways to safeguard against such a thing. And he told his partners he was backing out and that he still had no money. As it turns out, though, he still believed he could pull this off. Because that's the thing about, like, people like him. Like, he is so sure he's not going to get caught. He's so sure that he's so much smarter than everyone else and that he can talk his way out of it, even if he does get caught.
The narcissism is brutal.
It is unparalleled.
Wow.
So, he still believes he can pull it off, although what happened to this supposed body, I have no idea.
Tell me why this almost gives me, like, mafia vibes. Like, he just packaged up pieces of it, and then they went, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, got mailed to a dude somewhere.
Well, and this is all just according to him. Like, did he ever have the body in the first place? Did he actually sell the body somewhere else? Or, like, collect on a policy somewhere else and just, like, excluded?
Or sell it to a medical college? Yeah. Or
it literally could have been any of those things because of who we're talking about.
Or it could have not existed at all because he's probably a fucking liar.
Huge liar. Wow. Okay. I'm excited because we really haven't even begun yet. Like, there's so much
Did
more.
Did he do drugs?
Not that I'm aware of.
Was speed a thing then?
I think in that time it was mostly, like, opium and stuff.
Huh.
You could say that he was addicted to the feeling that he got either from manipulating people or lying to people or being in control. He's really big about being in control. Or about just, like, killing in general. Like, it was a high to him, I believe. Opium derivatives, including morphine and heroin, were particularly popular during the 1800s.
Huh.
Not only was it possibly a lie that this body ever existed at all, or what he did with it, or whatever, he also wasn't actually in need of money. He was boarding at this house in a city called Moore's Forks.
Moore's? Not Moore's.
Yeah, Moore's. I don't know, you guys. I'm sorry, it looks like Moore's. Like cows. Moore's.
It looks like Moore's.
Moore's Forks. If I'm saying that wrong and you're from there, I really apologize. Please feel free to correct me.
These are the forks that happen by the cows.
Yes. But anyway, while boarding at a house in that city, that town, the owner noticed that Mudgett often had large sums of money on hand. So, like, he's lying about needing money, too, and, like, not being able to find work. Or, like, maybe he got the money because he did do something with that body. You know what I'm saying? Like, it literally could be anything.
Katie's looking at me with, like... I wonder who this person actually was.
We're gonna talk about that,
too. I'm telling you, bro, it's a novella.
It really is. Yeah, welcome to Days of Our Lives. This is our fucking soap opera right now. So he leaves Moore's Forks at midnight without paying his lodging bill and heads to Philadelphia.
What an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, I saw this dude with fat stacks.
Yeah,
he popping bands. Out the cash. No big deal. And then he leaves without paying you.
Dips in the middle of the night, doesn't pay.
I mean, like, if you're murdering people and you literally built a murder castle, I don't expect you to do the right thing. But also, just what the fuck? That is so rude.
And you could just disappear like that in this time in America. Yeah. And so many people were using aliases anyway, which we'll find out he has dozens of them, that it became very hard to track him once he started moving around. So he gets to Philadelphia, he finds this drugstore, and he wants to become a partner or an owner in it. It turns out it doesn't work out for him, and so he takes a job at the Norristown Asylum. He quit after a few days because the experience shook him so badly. He said that the faces of the patients haunted him in his sleep.
Well, I mean, at the time, though, the things that were happening...
They were being tortured.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I was gonna try and find a nice way to say that, but those facilities were fucked up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, we're not in a great place with what's happening with all of that care, but it's come a long fucking way.
It has come a long way. It's getting more awareness. It's in the public eye a little bit more. It's, like you said, still not great, but hoo boy, way better than 1880s in Pennsylvania. Like...
Word.
Yeah. I didn't put this in my notes either, but Mudgett was raised by a, like, very strong religious family, his father especially. They didn't have a lot of money growing up, and they didn't really spend much time in the more pleasurable activities of life, like birthdays and Christmas celebrations. It was always like, shut up and go pray, eat your food and go pray, don't play with things, go pray, kind of. Like, that's how he was raised, so... So, eventually, he does get a job working at a drugstore in Philadelphia, and soon after he started his employment there, a child died from taking medicine from that pharmacy. He left quickly, again, without much notice.
Is this according to him, or...?
This is factual. He got the job there, a child died, he left very quickly. We don't know if he was connected to it, or if he just left because he was worried he'd be connected to it, or what, but factually that's what happened. He got the job there, a kid died from taking medicine that the child got from that pharmacy, and then Mudgett left.
Well, that's weird.
Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious.
That's weird.
Yeah. That's weird. We haven't said that in a while.
I know.
Bringing it back. So then he heads to Chicago. Okay, this is where it all starts to happen.
Oh, God.
He found out that he could not work as a druggist in Illinois without a license, even though he has a, yeah, that was the term they used for...
If I ever become a drug dealer, I'm going to be a druggist, not a drug dealer.
Pharmacy technician.
Street corner pharmacist.
Yeah.
Street corner druggist.
Druggist, that was just the term they used.
I love old-timey terms for jobs.
Yeah, so he didn't want to go about getting this license the normal way.
Because, of course not.
Of course not. Fuck that. It's so below him. So he forged the license, and he did this also to throw people off his scent should they come asking about the cadavers that he had, you know, maybe or maybe not acquired, the insurance fraud that he may or may not have committed, and the little boy... who took the medicine that he may or may not have killed. He also changed his name. So.
Okay.
He puts this new name on the license. He gets rid of any trace of Herman Webster Mudgett. He begins his new life in Chicago, Illinois, as a licensed druggist by the name of Henry Howard Holmes.
Some alliteration.
So in July of 1886, which was the same year... that a book with a detective by the name of Sherlock was published, he changed his name to Dr. H.H. Holmes.
Ew.
Right? Fucking everybody was reading Sherlock Holmes, dude. And he was like, yeah, I'm Holmes.
That's like being a doctor right now and being like, I'm Dr. McDreamy, whatever the fuck it is from Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
Sure the fuck you are.
Or like, yeah, I'm Dr. House. Like, fuck off. You are not.
Eat a dick and go home.
Seriously. So that's where his name change came from. That's how he picked his name. I know. Katie's rolling her eyes right now.
How BTK of him.
Exactly. Okay. My notes get very, scattered here for just a minute, and then I'm going to focus in again, I swear.
You got this.
So Chicago in the 1870s. There was this huge industrial boom. Everything needed to be, like, bigger and better and faster. And Paris had just held the World's Fair. And there were these huge exhibits. The Eiffel Tower was unveiled. These, like, feats of modern construction. And people were, like, shitting bricks about it. They were
industrial,
like, oh my god.
Revolution AF.
Yeah, they were, like, big building. Ooh, tall building. Wow. So tall. Like, it was...
much different. Very new.
Very big. So, now, the United States is selected for the World's Fair, but they need to decide where to hold it.
Is the World's Fair still a thing?
No, it was discontinued after a while. I think, honestly, because they kind of, like, ran out of money and room to do it, because we're gonna talk about this, but they literally built, like, basically another fucking town in Chicago for
you
this
mean,
fair.
Like the Olympics?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds yeah. like the Olympics.
Like the Olympic Village in Tokyo that was, like... poorly made and went up really fast. Yeah, it's a lot like yep. that, actually. So I guess we do still do the World's Fair, we just call it the Olympic Village.
Sans giant Ferris wheel, but here we are.
We're gonna talk about the Ferris wheel, too.
I'm fucking terrified of Ferris wheels.
You should be.
I'm scared of a
That's
lot of
That's what we're
things.
Gonna talk
Damn.
About. Yeah,
I'm
really,
a chicken.
This podcast should be called Things Katie's Afraid of. So, St. Louis... New York and Chicago had all put in a bid.
Wait a minute, you said this has everything. Does it have birds? I need a warning if it has birds.
It does not have birds.
Okay, I'm here for it.
There's actually very little animals. I'm gonna mention pigs briefly, and then I'm gonna move on.
Oh, again, things Katie's scared of. Yeah. Pigs.
Chicago was one of the top, like, butcher house, slaughterhouse capital of the United States. Like, they had a innovative new way of murdering the pigs, and everyone was very impressed by how efficient it was. They could slaughter so many hogs in one day.
Dusty looks fucking horrified, just
yeah,
so you guys can see her face
yeah,
right now.
Yeah, I don't know. They thought it was something really great, and I'm just fucking horrified by it. Like, they were like, look how many pigs we can kill so quickly and efficiently. And I'm just like, what the
Could
fuck?
Could you imagine anyone saying that to you now? You'd be like, what the fuck is the wrong fuck? With you, Susan? Go home!
Like, leave. Stop. Leave the pigs alone. Anyway.
Pig murder aside.
So, yeah. That's the brief mention of pigs.
Okay.
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 So Chicago had put in their bid, and it was a very close vote, but they finally, at the last second, managed to squeeze enough of the votes out at the last second to get the bid, okay?
Okay.
So now the race is on to put on the biggest, baddest World's Fair with even more over-the-top construction and exhibits and displays. They basically wanted to out-Eiffel the Eiffel, is what they started saying. It was, like, one of the terms. They wanted to, like, do it up big.
But why? Like, what? Why does... Why?
Because...
Why does that matter?
America. That's why. They, like, really needed to prove that they were the best. Also, Chicagoans were, during this time, seen as, like, dirty and lewd and dumb. They were like, it's just some stupid big city that's filthy. All they do is kill pigs, it's just butchers and cab drivers. The city was said to be rife with the stench of sewage and smoke, because you have all these hogs, and they're all shitting everywhere, and then you're killing them, which stinks, because now you have rotting meat, and you gotta, like, do something with that. And, like, it was, like, thick in the air, according to some people. That mm-hmm. and the smoke from all of the production, the industrial era.
Well, 1870s. Do they have... They don't have indoor plumbing at this point. No? You still dumping your poop out the window? That's what I'm asking
no,
you.
No, I don't think so. I think okay. you have...
We have Googled how many, like, so many times when the toilet was invented on this podcast.
Oh. The art and practice... I love that fucking Google said that. The art and practice of indoor plumbing took nearly a century to develop, starting in about the 1840s. In 1940, nearly half of houses lacked hot-piped water, a bathtub or shower, or a flush toilet. So I would say it is unlikely that they had indoor plumbing.
So you're also dumping your shit out of a window. No wonder it smells bad.
Yeah. And I'll go into this into a second, but basically they had built this place up so big and so fast and so poorly, because it was just like more, more, more without really like thinking about it, that the soil was fucked. And so like anytime they would try and build, they had to deal with like the soil constantly crumbling under them and washing out. And yeah. So, like I said, it literally says the next thing in my notes. Construction in general was fucking wild. Architecture and the race to build the tallest skyscraper. Because skyscrapers weren't really a thing yet. And then the ground was just really a problem for them. Every time they would try to make a building taller, the foundation would either sink or break apart, and then the whole building would collapse, and thousands of people died.
What the fuck?
Like, construction workers were dropping like flies, because this was a dangerous practice, and they didn't know what they were doing.
Hate it.
So they were trying to figure out a way that they could build taller without that happening, and many people were hurt and killed in the pursuit of tall building. Construction want tall building. We want big, tall building. Don't care if people die. Only tall building.
Tall like, building mean more money.
It boggles my fucking mind, bro.
Well, because how do you make more money on a city that has already expanded in one story? You stack them on top of each other.
We ain't got no more space, so we stacking them bitches. We gonna bunk bed this shit.
Energetically, I hate buildings where people live on top of each other.
Yes.
Hate it.
Yeah, the energy is whack.
It's gross.
How many of y'all have an upstairs neighbor that you like? That's what I thought.
Y'all missed the Chronicles of Katie and fuck her upstairs neighbor.
We're not living like that no more.
Thank God.
So, Daniel Burnham and John Root were two such architects during this time, and they were the best in the business.
They were not killing people by the troves.
I mean, they kind of were, but were, like, also one of the only two people to figure out how to build a skyscraper and not have it collapse and kill a bunch of people.
Okay.
So, like, they had some fuck-ups along the way, I'm not gonna lie.
I mean, you shit the bed while you're learning how to do something.
Exactly.
Sucking at something is the first step at being kinda good at something.
But they figured out how to build this one very tall building called the Rookery, and they put their offices on the top floor. And they were picked to build the main structures and design the layout and everything for the upcoming World's Fair.
It's kinda dirty to put your own office on the top. Like, if this thing does fall down, I'm not getting squished underneath all of y'all.
But also, they could see the whole city. They did windows, like, all across it. Yeah. And it was a fucking, like, dick move. Like slap your dick on the table. Like, here I am on top of the city, and yep. I control this. I run this shit. Like, they were smoking cigars and putting their feet up and shit like that.
Ooh. So, if a city smells that bad and you smoke inside...
Like I said, some people would come to Chicago and, like, get off the train and literally be like, ugh, as soon as they, like, stepped outside. And the Chicagoans are used to it, so they're like, what?
There were literally some parts of London like that, where I was like, damn, this smells like old coochie in here. What the fuck is wrong with this part of town?
I was just listening to something. I don't remember what it was. But there's this guy, and he went to a strip club. Oh, I think it was Bert Kreischek. He was talking about going to a strip club in Russia.
Oh, is this the machine?
Yes, the machine.
He's so funny.
And I hadn't heard this story before, because I've seen the special that is, like, the machine. I am the machine.
Word.
And this was a side story of when he was in Russia. So they go to a strip club, and, you know, they're getting a dance, and he's like, God, these girls smell bad.
Oh.
Like, they smell awful. And so he's like, do you want, like, the same girl or another girl? And he's like, I want another girl. So another girl comes in and he's like, oh my god, she fucking stinks too. And so then, like, some time goes by. I don't remember the story exactly. And he gets invited somewhere, like, out to eat, and it's at an Indian restaurant, and he walks in and he's like, oh my god, this smells exactly like those Russian strippers. It was curry. He'd never smelled curry before in his life.
Oh.
And the strippers had curry before their shift that night. And so, like, you know, it kind of comes out of your pores or, like, hangs in your hair a little bit. And so he just thought that that's what Russian strippers smelled like.
Meanwhile, they just had a fucking tasty ass lunch.
Yeah, dude. Curry is so good. I could eat curry every day.
I could fuck up some Indian food at any given point in the day.
Okay, here's where I mentioned the book. So, Larson's book goes into great detail about, like, the World's Fair, and the architects, and the planning, and the struggles they had to go through. Like, it was truly fascinating, but I chose not to include very much of that. The book was nearly 400 pages, and I do encourage you to go read it. It's called Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America by Eric Larson. Eric with a K.
P.S. Thanks, Barb.
Yes, I have that in here too. Thank you, Barb, for letting us borrow that. It was so helpful. Such a good book, and I really appreciate it.
It is in there.
So yeah, he does this really great job of alternating between the World's Fair timeline and then, like, what Burnham and his men are going through to try and pull this thing off, including a crazy-ass shooting involving the mayor.
Jesus.
And then he'll switch back to talking about Holmes, and then eventually the timelines merge. Like, it was so well done. So yeah, definitely check that out, even if you, like, listen to it on audiobook. I don't know if it's available, but like I said, Devil in the White City, Eric Larson. Thank you to Barb for letting me borrow it. And I said this earlier, but like 95% of my notes are from that book.
Word. I'm real glad that was helpful, bruh.
Yeah. Okay. Enter H.H. Holmes. So okay. I've given you the setting. Chicago. Preparing for the World's Fair. Industrial era.
Okay.
I've given you H.H. Holmes. Doing shady shit. Now, boom. Devil in the White City.
Worlds collide. Okay, how can a city that smells that bad still be white?
I don't recall why it's called the White City. And I always thought it was the Windy City, but I guess that's not it. I think that's... I'm gonna sound like an idiot. Is that Detroit?
No, this says Illinois.
Okay, Chicago is the Windy City. Fuck it.
Lake Michigan is in Illinois?
Yes.
Damn. I just learned something. If I sound stupid, I don't give a damn.
Just for the record, geography was my worst subject. Like, geography, history, social studies, all that shit, not good at it.
Fun fact, if it was Dusty's worst subject, it was my worst subject.
I was really good at, like, English, language arts, reading and writing, stuff like that. I was decent at math, too, which is why I was good at chemistry. I was good at chemistry, because chemistry is math. I was not good at physics. They were like, what is the potential energy of this ball? And I was like, I don't know, it's just fucking sitting there. What do you mean? Like, I did not get it. It was...
Our physics teacher was the shit, though.
She was. She let us go to this, protest. Like, we were part of at the time, the club was called the Gay Straight Alliance at our school. It's like a, you know, pro-LGBTQ club, because this was in, like, the early 2000s when it was, like, I don't know. Stuff was still developing as far as, like, how that works in the public eye.
I think schools still have GSA.
Yeah, they may be called something else, but Katie and I were in the GSA, and our sponsor, the teacher who, like, ran the club, he comes to us during our, like, sixth period physics class that we had together, and he's like, so, the Westboro Baptist Church is protesting outside of this high school that was, like, on the other side of town, like
the whole ass other side of Arizona,
probably like an hour drive from at our least. Little ass high school, and there's a counter protest going on, and I think we should be there. And me and Katie were like, "Fuck yeah, Mr. Johnson!"
Word.
And so we go up to our physics teacher, and we're like, "Hey, can we go with Mr. Johnson for this thing?" And she straight up looks at us, and she's like, "Is your lab work done?" And we were like, "Yeah," and she was like, go.
She's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
She was like, we never had this conversation.
Because fuck yeah, Mrs. Barkis.
And we straight up, like, walked out the back door by the band room, because we were band kids and we knew how to get out, got in my car, drove there, and then you couldn't park at the school, because the school was on, like, fucking lockdown. They were terrified, because they thought there was gonna be this huge protest. And so there was this guy outside with a megaphone, like a security guard, and he was like, if your child does not go here, like, if you are not picking up your child, your car cannot be on this property.
We will tow you, bitch.
So we parked at this little church, like, down the road, and then we straight up, like, stashed our stuff in a bush. I remember Mr. Johnson bailing out of his jacket and putting it in this bush, and I don't think we ever went back for it.
I don't think so either.
And we walk up, and there's straight up, like, five people there from the Westboro Baptist church.
I wouldn't even, maybe three.
And like, majority of them were people's children. Like, there was a few adults and a few children. With yep. their, like, you know, I hate to use this word, but the God hates, you know what, signs and stuff like that. And then there was probably somewhere in the area of 200, 300, counter-protesters.
Maybe 500, it was a lot of people.
Who were just there to be like, fuck you, Westboro Baptist Church. Like, you can get the fuck out with that bullshit.
That may or may not be episode-worthy.
And, like, it was great.
Just in general.
I think we just told the whole story, though.
No. I don't mean us going to the protest, but oh, I mean Westboro Baptist
Church. The Westboro
Church.
Baptist Church, yeah. Yeah. That's some spooky shit for sure.
I think it would be interesting.
I might get too mad talking about it, though.
I mean, I had to talk about how Diane Downs shot all three of her children.
Yep.
So. Fuck yep. that bitch.
I just listened to that episode today, too, because I was, you know, trying to get them listens up, and I was, hell like, yeah. getting mad all over again.
Yep.
So anyway, yeah, long story short, we went to a counter-protest where the protest itself was a fucking joke, and our high school teachers are certified badasses.
Yep. They really knew to keep me with you in high school, though. Like, if you don't put her in the same classes as Dusty, she's just gonna go nap and buy her teacher Starbucks. I ended up in two AP classes because Dusty was in them.
High school was a good time for me and Katie.
I want to meet the teachers who did our class placement, though. I'm sure I've met them, but I would love to be a fly on the wall.
I don't know what it looks like at the high school level, I'll be honest. At the elementary school level, we do what's called card sorts, where we have, like, the kid's name on a card and, like, some general information about them. Like, how are they academically? How are they behaviorally? Do they have any things we need to know about, such as a individual education plan, a 504 plan, a behavior plan, a medical issue? Anything like that. Like, do they qualify for SPED? Like, what is it? And we just kind of go, all right, does everybody have about the same number of kiddos? And nobody has, like, an overwhelmingly amount of, like, really high academic kids or, like, really, like, strong behavior kids. Like, it's pretty even. We're good. All right, cool. And then still, I'll get the rosters because I see every child in the school, and I'll be like, damn it, y'all put this kid together again? And they'll be like, what do you mean? And I'll be like, this is the same child in two different bodies, and you just put them together.
Because you know that it's toxic.
Yeah. And I'm straight up like, why did you do this? And they're like, we didn't know. And I'm like, why didn't you ask me? I know them all.
Bro, are you the librarian?
You just set everyone up for, like, double trouble for the next 180 school days. Because those kids don't never be absent either.
Aww.
Not never. No, truly, I do love all of my students. They're all wonderful and special and unique in their own ways.
Sometimes they're just assholes.
Every once in a while. Which, like, everyone's an asshole sometimes.
It's true.
It happens. We all yep. have bad days, and kids are entitled to bad days, too.
It's true.
Yeah. Okay.
Squirrel. Sorry.
Big squirrel. We are back on track.
We're doing
so,
it.
When he first gets to Chicago, he finds this pharmacy owned by a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Holton. Now, according to what I found, Mr. Holton became sick and eventually passed away. A lot of stories tell it that he, like, died immediately and you know, Mrs. Holton became a widow. But I guess Holmes was a pretty good employee, and he worked hard, and he saw that Mrs. Holton was grieving, aka vulnerable.
Ew.
And so he convinced her to sell him the pharmacy, and he said, you can still live in the apartment upstairs and, you know, collect a percentage of the sales, but I'll take over all of the inventory and the management and the, you know, the
you
bookkeeping.
Seem stressed.
And,
let
like,
me take this off your plate.
I'll take care of everything, Mrs. Holton. She agreed, and he took over, renaming the place H.H. Holmes Pharmacy. Many people in the city liked this young, handsome new doctor who had taken over the place, though they wondered about old Mrs. Holton, because a lot of these people, they had been coming here for medicine since they were kids. Like, Mrs. Holton knew their whole families, their kids, their grandkids, all that stuff.
Word.
Was she all right? Had she gone out? Where was she? They asked him. At first, Holmes fed them a story that she was visiting family in California, something she just hadn't been able to do with her husband so ill right before his death. She had to stay by his side, so she couldn't see her family, so now she was traveling to see her family in California, he told them. As time wore on, he changed his story slightly. Now he told them that Mrs. Holton had liked California so much that she decided to relocate there permanently. Mm-hmm.
He killed her.
Mm-hmm.
He done did her.
And you're gonna find that this happens a lot. Somebody just goes missing, and they ask Holmes about it, and he goes, oh yeah, they moved. Just up and left. It's odd. It's a funny business. Yeah, they just left. Like I said.
They can't ping her Fitbit watch.
For real.
But she dead in a forest somewhere.
Indeed.
That's scary.
So after some time, he purchased the empty lot across from the pharmacy and began to develop a two-story mixed-use building. And the top floor was to be apartments, and the bottom would include several retail spaces. In the retail spaces, Holmes included a barbershop, a restaurant, the office of a Dr. Henry D. Mann, likely an alias used by Holmes.
Hey, y'all. I'm D. Mann.
D. Mann. Henry D. Mann. Dr. Mann. Dr. Henry D. Mann. Yeah. A lot of them are stupid as hell like that, too. Like, when you read them out loud, you're like, somebody fucking fell for this?
Sounds like a Bart Simpson thing.
I think one of them, he calls himself Mr. Manly. Like, I'm not even making this shit up. He's making this shit up. Like, he did that.
On the fly.
And a glassmaking shop that specialized in the newly booming business of making large sheets of glass all in one piece. So prior to this, you could only make, like, smaller panes of glass, and now they're talking about, like, these huge storefront windows made from one solid piece of glass. And so this was, like,
I wonder if that's why stained glass was so common.
That could be, yeah. So it was really, like, quickly rising business, and so he got into that, too. He figured out that that was a moneymaker. He sold the old Holton Pharmacy to a man and promised him that he wouldn't have much competition. He then promptly opened a drugstore in the corner shop of his new building. Ass.
Rude.
Yeah.
That's so dirty.
Yeah. Like, I gotta hand it to him. He's slicker than shit and smart as a whip, but he's such a dick.
So fucking greedy.
Now, Holmes took a peculiar approach to building at the site. It's really similar to the Winchester House, if you've ever heard that story, and even kind of similar to the Denver Airport, which we already discussed. He would hire people to do the job, and then when they would complete it, he would get pissed and say they did it all wrong and refuse to pay them. Well, obviously, they'd get upset, and they'd demand payment. They would demand payment for the job completed, and then he would, quote, fire them and get part of his building made for free. He would also tell someone to work on one very small part of the building, like a gas line or a room with lots of solid insulation, and not tell them anything else about the space.
So nobody had a complete blueprint of this fucked up building.
And, like, the target was constantly moving. He was like, you do this, you do that, divide and fucking conquer. Nobody knew what the fuck was going on. Nobody knew why they were building what they were building, or how it was connected, or how it was all supposed to work when it was finished.
Why do you have a freezer 10 stories deep? Mm-hmm. Oh, I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know the construction of it was like this.
He was also going through construction workers like toilet paper. Like, he was just, like, hiring them and firing them, and they would go missing.
I was gonna say, did he fire them, or did they suddenly move away?
Could be either one. He was also really good at conning people and getting shit for free.
What a dick.
So he would buy, like, furnishings and fixtures for the shop, like couches, tables, counters, things like that. And then he would buy these on credit with no intention of paying them off.
That's rude. And credit in that day was like, you write your name down on this piece of paper and promise to come back.
Literally. And he was such a shitlord about it.
Well, and he'd be like, Henry D. Mann. And then be like, that's not my name.
Literally. Or he'd be like, yeah, he's not here right now, but I'll pass along the message.
That's my brother. Fucking asshole. He didn't pay for anything.
And then he would dismiss or avoid the creditors. Like, he would just, like, be like, nah, you know, like, no. Or he would go hide or whatever. He wouldn't be there. And then, in some cases, he would send the furniture somewhere else and be like, I never got that furniture from you. What the fuck are you talking about? Or,
I never got it. Send me it.
Or he would sell it to someone else. So now he got it on credit, made money by selling it to someone else, and when the creditors come after him for it, he's like, I don't have that piece of furniture.
Come inside. Go ahead.
Couldn't have been me. It's not here.
Like, this is why you don't buy things sometimes from people that you don't know. Did I send you that Instagram of the lady who bought a TV from a guy in a parking lot and it ended up being a fucking KFC menu sign?
I have seen that before, yes. Yeah, he would tell them it had been stolen or he never purchased it in the first place. Like I said, he was extremely charismatic. He could talk his way out of anything.
Ew.
So then, there's this man, C.E. Davis, that Holmes had hired to run the drugstore jewelry counter, and he's quoted as saying, "He was the smoothest man I ever saw." He said that creditors would, quote, "come here raging and calling him all the names imaginable, and he would smile and talk to them and set up the cigars and drinks and send them away seemingly his friends for life. I never saw him angry. You couldn't have trouble with him if you tried."
I mean, you weren't even talking to him, though. You were talking to his mustache.
Yeah. Which, by the way, when you look at him, you can tell that he had this effect on people. He's, like, I hate to say it, but he's not bad looking.
Okay, but if you cut that mustache off, yes, the fuck he is. Also, I looked up his body count.
Which is estimated. We'll get to that, too. Like, and the other thing is that he confessed to several murders, and we'll talk about the confessions and the facts behind that, too. We're getting there. I swear we are. Bro. We have not even fucking begun. Let me just tell you.
Half his face is so droopy.
Is it really? Like, I didn't notice.
He look a little dim. Or maybe it's not a flattering picture, but I don't know, man.
Okay, I'm not gonna go on for too much longer about this, but, like, the moral of the story is he was really fucking slick. He once convinced a group of investors that he had invented a machine which could turn water into natural gas.
What the fuck?
He sold it to all of them, hook, line, and sinker.
Wow.
In reality, he had just hooked up the device to run from the city's gas lines.
What a dick.
Son of a bitch. Like... Right? Like, you have to laugh, because it is kind of fucking clever.
Could you imagine getting duped that fucking hard?
I think I would simply leave town. I would be like, I cannot live here any longer.
My Uber's here and I have to go. I
have to go now. So anyway, the World's Fair exposition is coming up, and the men involved in its construction are panicking and trying to build an entire fucking city in less than a year.
Which is a terrible idea.
H.H. Holmes is a shifty character, very smart, loves the ladies, looking to make some dough. Construction on the murder castle has begun, but it's not anything sinister yet. Everything's starting to come together.
Okay.
Now, of course, Holmes sees the World's Fair being built and the attention that it's attracting. Gears start turning in his head. This is going to invite a lot of tourists to Chicago. Literally thousands of people are going to come here and experience the fair. These people are going to be in a new city, helpless and vulnerable, and they're gonna need a place to stay.
Ew.
So, Holmes goes back to his investors and he convinces them that he needs to add a third story onto the building, as a hotel, for the guests, out of the goodness of his heart. After all, his building is right at the edge of the land being used for the fair. It just makes sense, right? Right.
Sounds like crazy mania thoughts all spun together.
Yup.
Whew!
So... construction begins on a third story atop this already haphazard building. Like, when I told you about the shady construction practices earlier with the professional architects, Holmes is, like, so far from that. He was using, like, really awful materials, the cheapest wood you could get. He would hire any goddamn person. And then, like I said, he wouldn't even let these people complete their jobs most of the time. Like, this place was rickety as shit.
Is it still standing?
No.
Okay.
But there is a building on that property.
Ugh.
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
I know I've said that a lot, but
no,
like...
but I'm here for it. Okay, go, go, go.
Okay. So the construction on the hotel portion was never technically fully completed, and it's said that the hotel was never really open to the public, although it does seem clear that people paid to stay in the building, either in the second floor apartments or on the top floor hotel rooms. It's, again, it's the 1880s and 1890s, there's a lot of press sensationalism, there's a lot of loose record keeping, lots of lies and slander, it's fun times. All I'm saying is all of this is very debatable. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Yeah. So in May of 1890, construction was quote-unquote complete on Holmes's new building.
The Perfect!
Yeah.
It is complete!
And I didn't include this in my notes, but they said that, like, the hallways had been made, like, kind of narrow with way too many doors, and the lights were, like, spread few and far between. So, like, no matter what time of day or year, the hallways were fucking dark and dimly lit and spooky as shit.
How murdery.
Seriously. The second floor had 6 corridors, 35 rooms, and 51 doors. I'm gonna say that one more time. 35 rooms and 51 doors.
I hate it. I hate it so much.
Right? Like, where the fuck do these doors go? The answer is nowhere and everywhere. You know those, like, D.S. Escher paintings where, like, the stairs are going up and it's, like, a 3D mindfuck? That's how I imagine the inside of this hotel.
And how many of them were to, like, laundry chutes full of bodies?
Mm-hmm.
Hate it.
Or just chutes straight to the basement.
What the fuck?
We'll talk about it.
What the fuck?
Okay. That's the theme of this episode. We'll talk about it. The third floor had 36 rooms, and the first floor had 5 retail stores. The building took up nearly the whole city block. Holmes decided he would charge $1,000 for his hotel rooms.
Like a night?
Which is equivalent to about $30,000 today. I think it was for the month, or okay. I don't recall. Okay. Which, that sounds insane, right? Like, people were making $100 a year.
But bro, look at what people pay to go to the Olympics.
Or Disneyland!
On God.
But honestly, like, I have it written here right in my notes, people would pay it. To go to the World's Fair, like, people are literally coming from all over the world to come to Chicago, see the World's Fair, and stay within spitting distance of the fair. Like, you could walk 5 minutes, and you're there. So, yeah, he was gonna make a killing.
Ugh.
Poor choice of words, sorry. So, very soon after this, Holmes puts an advertisement out for more construction workers. He had more work to do, it seemed, to accommodate the needs of Chicago's guests and perhaps satisfy his own needs. He entered into a partnership with 3 other men, Charles Chappell, Patrick Quinlan, and Benjamin Pitezel. I'm not going to talk too much about them, but remember those names.
Okay.
In early 1891, Holmes set about making modifications to the hotel. He continued his same ruse as before, separating workers by delegating small tasks in different parts of the building so nobody was working together on the same thing, hiring and firing parties at will, and keeping all the master plans a secret that only he knew. I should also mention briefly here that Holmes had fallen in love with a woman named Myrta Wilmette. They had gotten married and had a child together, a daughter named Lucy. This wouldn't really present a problem, except for the fact that, like, oh yeah, he's still married to Clara and has a kid with her.
Scandalous.
Now, even though the two had been separated for years, their marriage was still legally binding.
Word.
So Holmes filed for divorce, citing infidelity on her part.
What a dick.
Of course was fucking bullshit. It was unfounded and ultimately untrue, and the case was dismissed. Partially because it was bullshit, and partially because Holmes couldn't keep his paperwork together. Like, he either failed to sign by a certain date or, like, lost it or something. So technically the divorce never went through, but he married Myrta anyway. So now he technically has 2 wives.
This really does have everything.
It really does. And he's gonna have a lot of wives. I'm just gonna preface right now.
Wow.
Like I said, he has a modus operandi for, like, serial marriage as well.
Serial wifery.
Yeah. So, Holmes had enlisted the financial investment of Jonathan Belknap, the great uncle of his new wife, Myrta. So, he wrote a check in the amount of $2,500 to help build a home where Myrta and Holmes could live together, as they were currently living separately. Holmes was very busy with his work and the construction, and he wouldn't come around much. When he did come around, he would shower Myrta with affection, bring gifts for Lucy, play with her and cuddle her, and basically act like a great dad and husband. Hell yeah, he did.
Ew.
He also assured Belknap that a home for the two of them to share would solve all their problems and they'd have a happy, healthy marriage.
Or not.
Now, some way or another, Holmes convinced Belknap to come to Chicago and see the hotel and tour it, like, as a show of good faith, I guess. Like, here's part of what I'm using your money for, something like that. So anyway, Holmes gets the check for $2,500, and he promptly forges Belknap's signature on a new check in the same amount.
What the fuck?
So a total of $5,000 if he pulls this off. As they're getting to Chicago, Belknap complains of the smell, isn't impressed by the sights, and basically doesn't want to fucking be there.
Well.
They tour the building, and Holmes is showing off all his fancy rooms and corridors.
And doors and doors and doors.
And he tries to get Belknap up on the roof to have a look at how that's coming along.
No.
Belknap declines, but only after a bit of back and forth, aka arguing about the matter. Now, after a lot more arguing, Holmes convinces him to stay in the hotel that night. Again, Belknap is very wary, but he eventually gets worn down because, again, Holmes is very persuasive. Belknap even talks about that. He's like, I didn't want to do any of those things, and I did almost all of them that he asked of me.
What the fuck?
So he accepts. He said that on that night, he went to bed and he made sure the door was locked behind him. Sometime in the middle of the night, he is awoken by the sound of someone jiggling the doorknob. Trying to open it.
I hate it.
He stiffens and listens, and a moment later, he hears a key in the lock.
No!
Because who would have a fucking key to this room?
No, no!
He called out, "Who's there?" And the sound stopped. And then he heard footsteps shuffling away down the hall.
Ew.
The next morning, Belknap dips because he's like, this motherfucker is trying to moita me.
On God.
He said that he was positive that if he'd gone up on the roof, he would have been killed and Holmes would have collected the $5,000.
Yep.
Instead, he discovered the forgery.
Bitch to got which, caught.
Of course, Holmes apologized profusely, claiming that he was desperate for money, he just couldn't think of anything else to do, blah blah blah, snake charmer, silver-tongued little devil, and Belknap forgives him and leaves town.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
What the fuck?
What the fuck?
Okay.
Okay. That's where we're gonna stop for part one. I think this actually might be a three-parter, so I will get part one and part two out to you guys as soon as possible. Thank you for listening, and, yeah, we'll get part three out to you eventually.
Yep.
Remember, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
I hate that that's on the Murder Castle.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.